This recording was made at a public hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on Wednesday, January 25th. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. A special session of the Federal Election Commission for Wednesday, January 25th, 2006 will please come to order. I'd like to welcome everyone to the Commission's hearing on proposed revisions to the Commission's rules regarding coordinated communications. At the outset, I'd like to note that Commissioner Walther is attending to a personal matter that has long been on his calendar and cannot be with us for the hearing, but the Commissioner is here with us in spirit and indicated that he looks forward to reading the transcript of the enlightening testimony we're going to receive over the next couple of days. Today we're going to discuss the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking on Coordinated Communications, which was published in the Federal Register on December 14, 2005. The NPRM explored several alternative proposals for revising the content prong of the Coordinated Communications Rules, consistent with the District Court and Court of Appeals decisions in Shays versus Federal Election Commission. Additional issues regarding the content prong, the conduct prong, and the payment prong of the Coordinated Communications Rules were also addressed in the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. I'd like to thank our staff and the Office of General Counsel for their hard work on this rulemaking and getting us to where we are today. I'd also like to thank all the people who are going to be appearing before us in the coming today and tomorrow to comment on these proposed rules. We appreciate your testimony very much, and we value it a tremendous amount. I'd like to describe briefly the format that we will be following for the next 2 days. We expect to have a total of 18 witnesses who have been divided into 6 panels. We will hear from 3 panels today and 3 panels tomorrow. We plan to have each panel last for approximately 90 minutes. We will have a short break between the first 2 panels of the day, and then we will take a lunch break after the second panel. Each witness will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement, and we have a light system that I will try my best not to totally screw up. That will allow you to have a sense of how much time you have remaining. The green light will start to flash when you have 1 minute left in your time. The yellow light will go on when you have 30 seconds left, and the red light means that you are done. Well, in all seriousness, that it was time to wrap up your remarks at that time. The balance of the time is reserved for questioning by the Commission. For each panel, we will have at least 1 round of questions from the Commissioners, the General Counsel, and our Acting Staff Director, and there will be a second round of questions if time permits and if there's an interest in having a second round. With that, appreciate very much the witnesses being with us and look forward to their testimony. I understand that some of my colleagues would like to make opening statements. Mr. Vice Chairman? Okay. Other people who would like to make an opening statement? Okay, great. Well, then we'll get right to it. Our first panel today consists of Jan Barron on behalf of the United States Chamber of Commerce, Bob Bauer on behalf of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and Donald Simon on behalf of Democracy 21. Welcome. And I think our usual approach is to go in alphabetical order in terms of opening statements. So I think that with that, we would have Mr. Barron go first, followed by Mr. Bauer and Mr. Simon. So, Mr. Barron, at your leisure.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission, I appreciate this opportunity to appear before you on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States. The Chamber was founded in 1916 and is the world's largest not-for-profit business federation, representing 3 million businesses, 3,000 state and local chambers, 830 business associations, and 87 American chambers of commerce abroad. As you know, the Chamber has a long-standing interest in the regulation of campaign finance. It previously submitted comments on October 11, 2002, in the original rulemaking, and submitted comments in this proceeding on January 13 of this year. The Chamber was one of the plaintiffs in McConnell versus FEC and has litigated First Amendment issues on its own behalf in cases such as Chamber of Commerce versus FEC regarding this agency's membership rulemaking attempts, and Chamber of Commerce versus Moore, Fifth Circuit case. And most recently, it filed an amicus curiae brief in the Supreme Court case of Wisconsin Right to Life, which was decided earlier this week. The Chamber has a continuing interest in the FEC's regulations, and particularly the manner in which this agency regulates so-called coordinated expenditures. As we all know, an expenditure that is coordinated with a campaign or party can become a contribution under the campaign finance laws. Corporations, including not-for-profit corporations like the Chamber, are barred from law, by law, from making contributions. Therefore, it is essential that the FEC promulgate rules that place the regulated community on notice as to when spending is a contribution and when it is not. Our formal and extensive comments of January 13 can be summarized as urging the FEC to do two things. First, the Chamber urges the Commission to recognize the numerous First Amendment implications of regulations in this area. Citizens and organizations, including the Chamber, have First Amendment rights of free speech, free association, and the right to petition government for the redress of grievances. The Chamber's major purpose is to exercise those rights on behalf of its members. Accordingly, any regulations implemented by the FEC regarding coordination must provide clear, bright lines and must be within the constitutionally permissible field of regulation. Second, the Chamber urges the Commission to limit this rulemaking only to those changes that are necessitated as a result of Shays versus FEC. In that regard, the question raised by the decision is whether the 120-day rule is sustainable, and if not, whether there is an alternative rule that should be promulgated. In this regard, the Chamber recommends three options to the Commission. First, it may find in this proceeding sufficient and new justification of the current 120-day rule. Second, the FEC may consider adopting instead a rule that emulates the 30 and 60-day electioneering communications rules. Finally, the third option is that the FEC has at its disposal long-standing precedent reflected in its so-called polling allocation rules, which for almost three decades, without challenge, have recognized that certain campaign-related information is virtually valueless after 60 days and literally valueless after 180 days. Whatever you do, our request is to please give us clear, understandable rules, I would add constitutional rules, that we can comply with. I would be glad to discuss further any of these points and look forward to the Commission's questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Mr. Bauer?
No, it doesn't move. Does not move. Okay, if I'm heard. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. I appreciate the opportunity to appear. I have not, and this has been my custom before the Commission, I have not tried to replicate my testimony again here today in a spoken form here for you. I'm here really primarily to answer questions about the comments submitted on behalf of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which, as you know, were submitted jointly with the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. I would only stress a couple of points. First, unlike the Chamber, our view is that this is an opportunity not merely to explain what you wish to do and to keep close to the constitutional lines in doing it, but it's an opportunity for you to reconsider the 120-day period in the content regulation. And we believe, and the Chamber has indicated it's one of the options the Chamber supports, that emulating the period set out in the electioneering communication prohibition is an appropriate way to go. This is because those who criticized the original formulation did not believe that the 120 days were anchored in anything particularly definite or useful or related to the regulatory purpose. Certainly, the electioneering communication provision, reviewed again recently by the United States Supreme Court in Wisconsin Right to Life, sets out time frames that for some period of time the reform community argued were very directly related to the kinds of activity this agency is concerned with and that Congress was concerned with in regulating electioneering communications. And so we would look in that direction. I will say Mr. Barron's suggestion that the polling regulations offer some support for that point of view, at least at the 60-day level, is a novel one, and I think it's worth pursuing and thinking about. In any event, we would also urge, having said earlier that I hope the Commission is able to keep to the constitutional line here, that it is recognized how significantly these particular rules, having to do explicitly with communications, bear on fundamental constitutional rights and require the Commission to act with a view toward promulgating bright-line rules. These are, after all, communication rules. The standards we're discussing are content rules, content, that is, of communication. And for that reason, it's important that the regulated community understand, those generally involved in political speech understand, when that speech is likely to bring regulatory restrictions into play. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer. Mr. Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the third rulemaking on coordination in 6 years. In 2000, the Commission abandoned its coordination rule that had been in place for 25 years since Buckley and adopted a narrow agreement or collaboration test for coordinated activity. In Section 214 of BCRA, Congress repealed this rule and directed the Commission to try again. The legislative history of BCRA makes clear that Congress found the Commission's 2000 rule to be far too narrow a definition of coordination, and that Congress intended the Commission to broaden the scope of the rule in its rewrite. In the 2002 rulemaking that followed, the Commission did drop the language that offended Congress, the agreement or collaboration test, but then took away with one hand what it gave with the other by adding a wholly new content test for coordinated communications. This content test radically shrunk the definition of what constitutes an expenditure for coordination purposes, covering only ads that mention a candidate within 120 days of an election, and beyond that, only express advocacy. The Shays litigation followed. The district court threw out the rule as contrary to law. The D.C. Circuit, on the other hand, merely held it to be arbitrary and unexplained. As the court said, although Congress abrogated the old collaboration or agreement standard, the new rule permits significant categories of expression, even where formal collaboration or agreement occurs. It's hard to imagine representatives and senators voting for BCRA would have expected regulations like these. The thrust of the court's opinion is that the 120-day rule can stand, if at all, only if the Commission presents a compelling record that no substantial election-related communications occur outside the 120-day window. As the appendices to our comments illustrate, this showing cannot be made. Such campaign ads do occur outside the 120-day window, and if coordinated with candidates as permitted by the current rule, would represent a major breach in the contribution limits and source prohibitions of the law. In this rulemaking in response to Shays, a surprising number of commenters urge you to replace the 120-day rule with a time frame test of less than half its scope, the 30-60-day rule imported from Title II of BCRA. It would be both bizarre and ironic, not to mention, I believe, illegal, for the Commission to replace a rule whose narrowness was viewed with great skepticism by the courts in Shays with a new rule that would be more than twice as narrow in scope. The D.C. Circuit did not invalidate the 120-day rule because the Commission had failed to justify why it is so broad. Quite the contrary. The Circuit Court's question is whether the rule is too narrow. Now, let me make three additional points as to why it would be extremely ill-advised for the Commission to adopt the 30-60-day test in this context. First, the Commission itself considered and explicitly rejected this idea in the 2002 rulemaking, saying in the E&J that this test is inappropriately under-inclusive and discussing the important differences between the use of the 30-60-day test in the context of independent electioneering communications versus the context of coordinated communications. Having faulted the applicability of this test to coordinated communications, there's no rational basis for the Commission to change its analysis now. Second, I believe this idea is foreclosed by the Shays decision. Against attacks by plaintiffs that the 120-day rule was too narrow, the Commission defended the rule by reference to how much more generous it is than the benchmark 30-60-day test used by Congress in Title II. The D.C. Circuit found this unpersuasive, noting that while electioneering ads, and here the court was referring to the 30-60-day test, while electioneering ads are clearly one category of communications that may count as coordinated expenditures under BCRA, nothing in the statute suggests they represent the only or even primary such category. To use the Title II frame alone, when the court rejected time frames based on multiples of it, would surely violate the court's reasoning. Finally, this test would mean that express advocacy would be the only standard for coordination outside the 30-60-day window. As the Shays Court noted in the context of the 120-day rule, by employing a functionally meaningless standard outside that period, the FEC has in effect allowed a coordinated communications free-for-all for much of each election cycle. If that's true for a window of 120 days, it is obviously even more so for a time frame of less than half that length. The Commission, in its 2000 rulemaking, strongly rejected reliance on an express advocacy standard for coordination, as did the District Court in the Christian Coalition case, which called that standard fanciful, untenable, pernicious, and unpersuasive. What this would mean is that a candidate could hand an ad script to a corporate spender, along with directions on where and when to run the ad prior to the first week of September in an election year, and the corporation could finance a $100,000 ad buy so long as the ad avoided express advocacy. This would simply reinstate a new version of the soft money system and would eviscerate the ban on corporate contributions to candidates. The problem's not with the use of a time frame per se, but with the use of a time frame as an exclusive test. In our comments, we have outlined an alternative proposal, and I urge you to give it serious consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simon. I'll begin the questioning in our rotation. I'd like to start to see if we have consensus on at least some of the legal issues. And Mr. Barron, I'd like to start with you. Is it clear in your view after the Circuit Court ruling in Shays that the Commission can appropriately have a content standard in its coordination regulations and, as part of that, can appropriately take into account in the rules the proximity, the closeness to an election in terms of when a communication errs? Is it clear as a matter of law, in your view, that that's permissible after the
I believe it's clear in reading the opinion. I don't know how my colleagues feel about it. I read the opinion as basically not overturning anything in your existing coordination rules except this 120-day issue. And even then, the court said it may be valid, but you haven't explained it and you haven't justified it. So your responsibility, as I see it, is to either justify that 120-day period, and if you conclude that it cannot be justified, then provide some alternative clear, bright line, which may be a shorter or a longer period of time, depending on what justification you find.
And so that after the Circuit Court ruling, the Commission can and appropriately can fashion a content standard that includes proximity to an election.
Yes, and I think that that's already been somewhat alluded to in by the Supreme Court and the Colorado One decision, which we reference in our formal comments.
Mr. Bauer, do you concur in those judgments that in light of the Circuit Court ruling, that really is the law of the case, as it were?
Yes.
Mr. Simon, you agree?
Well, I think there can be a content standard. I think there always has been a content standard in the coordination rule. It hasn't been in the Commission's regulations, but I think it's been in the statute, and I think the Commission has applied a content standard through advisory opinions, and some of which we cited in our comments. So the answer to that question is yes. As to the proximity issue, the Circuit Court said that the Commission can take account of time, place, and content as indicia of whether a communication constitutes an expenditure. So I think proximity to an election is a factor that can be taken into account, and indeed I think, as we suggest in our comments, it should be taken into account. As I said in my opening statement, the problem we have with the existing rule is not that it uses a time frame test, but that it uses a time frame test exclusively, both in the sense that it leaves a gap between the primary and the general period, and also that the only test prior to the pre-primary time frame is express advocacy, and I think the Commission needs to deal with that.
Well, in light of that, if there's general consensus that under the Circuit Court ruling the Commission can have a content standard, and as part of that content standard can take proximity to the election into account, then it may become an issue of what type of evidentiary record we need to justify that type of decision-making. And Mr. Barron, is it your view that if we decided to adopt a 30 and 60-day time dimension, that we essentially could draw upon the congressional record that was built up in the BICRA legislation in terms of the electioneering communications rules?
I think you can refer to the congressional record. I think you can also refer to the record, which was voluminous, that was developed in McConnell versus FEC. And the interveners in that case produced extensive evidence about the amount of non-party, non-candidate advertising that occurred in the 30-60-day period. I think they even had graphs that showed that there was essentially a flat line until you got about 60 days before an election, and then all of a sudden it rose. Now, that was pre-McCain-Feingold. I think Mr. Simon and his colleagues may have unwittingly provided you with even more persuasive evidence in their submission in this proceeding.
In what respect?
Well, I last night tried to go through all of it, and I don't pretend that I have, but I did read their comments, and in particular on page 26 of their comments, they refer to their Appendix 5, which contains ads by candidates, parties, and independent organizations, and they say that more than 120 days prior to the 2004 primary and general elections, there were 65 television radio ad broadcasts that are contained in Appendix 5. I went through Appendix 5, and those 65 ads, all but four were ads by candidates. And there were four ads by non-candidate organizations. Only three of organizations produced four ads. And those three organizations were the Chamber, which had one ad in Alaska, the American Conservative Union, which had an ad in Pennsylvania, and the Main Street Republican Organization, or Partnership, which is, according to their website, an organization essentially controlled by elected officials, by candidates, including, I might add, Senator McCain and Congressman Shays, according to this organization's website. So, therefore, you have four non-candidate ads that are in this record that occurred more than 120 days prior to an election. And of those four ads, two of them were sponsored by an organization that was controlled by candidates. So you have two non-candidate ads more than 120 days. And that's your record here. And, of course, no allegation that there was any coordination by any of these groups. I assume that they're not suggesting that you should promulgate a regulation prohibiting coordination by candidates with their own campaigns. So, therefore, the 61 ads that are part of this record do not shed any light on whether or not your current 120-day rule is ineffective. And it seems to me that the record post McCain-Feingold indicates that there really is not a problem with your 120-day rule.
My time has expired, but if there's time for a second round, I definitely would like to have a follow-up on this, but my time has expired. Vice Chairman Linhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to follow up on that question, though, because I think that the point that was raised by those examples was more subtle than whether outside groups were spending money in this environment, but rather whether outside of the 120-day time period people were engaged in efforts to influence elections. And one of the questions that the circuit court asked us was whether there was a risk in if we established a line at 120 days or an even shorter one, whether organizations or groups would use that as an opportunity to coordinate and spend money that they otherwise wouldn't be permitted to do. And my sense of that record was that they were showing that people were trying to influence elections in those time periods. Do you have a sense of if we adopt what you're suggesting, which is would be a shorter time period, or even try to found a record that justified the 120-day time period, whether there is a risk that this would lead to greater circumvention of the law?
Well, all I can do is look at what evidence has been submitted. And of course, our first suggestion is if you can justify the 120-day rules, I think that's what you ought to do. Mm-hmm. Because it is a rule that you have in place. It's a rule that people apparently have attempted to follow. One of our recommendations is don't rewrite your coordination rules. I mean, they've been in effect for one election cycle. Frankly, it seems to me that they work. And if in future election cycles there is evidence of some circumvention or of abuse, well, then yes, based on a new record, perhaps you need to revise your regulations. But based on this record, as I understand it, there's no demonstration here either of widespread circumvention of your existing 120-day rule, let alone with respect to the minuscule number of advertisements that that were sponsored by non-candidate and non-party groups, there doesn't seem to be any allegation of coordination. So if that is the record, then it seems to me that you have quite a bit of substantiation that you could offer a court in any future challenge for your 120-day rule. If that's not satisfactory, then I think you have to look for similar justification for an alternative rule. Whether this proceeding is going to provide you with sufficient evidence to justify a 30-60-day rule, I don't know. I don't see any demonstration of how many of these types of ads were run outside of the 30 and 60 days. But alternatively, you could extend 120 days, some longer period of time that might encompass even those handful of ads that were run outside of the 120 days. So I think it's a matter of record.
Yeah. The
can you just, how much time do I have on this?
Okay. What's if I have a question? I have a question for either you or Mr. Bauer. What's the harm? What's the harm if we adopt a stringent rule in this context and regulate this? Isn't this a, you know, if, to the degree that, that people are concerned about their ability to lobby, isn't this resolved simply by not communicating with parties or candidates as they sort of put together their plans on doing advertising? It doesn't seem to prohibit people from meeting with members of Congress in their capacity as members of Congress or even leaders of you know, the minority leader, the majority leaders in Congress. Congress, what harm do we do by imposing these kinds of restrictions?
Well, with all due respect, for my part, I would say that's asking the wrong question. I wouldn't ask the question, what's the harm? I'd ask the question, what's the justification? Because if you're circumscribing speech, and granted there's authority for this commission to do so, constitutional authority that Congress exercises and has delegated to the agency, no question about it, within, of course, constitutional limits. But if you are circumscribing speech nonetheless, then you want to go about doing so in a very cautious and deliberate fashion. And the question you need to ask each time you extend the restrictions on speech is, what's the justification? And so I don't think that the commission should accept the notion that the justification it needs to offer is a justification for protecting speech. It needs to find a justification that's appropriate and easily articulated for some effective balance between the critical speech rights that it has to nonetheless keep an eye on, as well as its regulatory authority to implement the statute. I have, don't mean to cut into your time,
nope,
Mr. Rescher, but
please.
I did want to mention one thing. I'm not terribly I'm very persuaded by Mr. Barron's use of the material drawn from the comments of Democracy 21, and I'm sure we'll hear from Mr. Simon about that. I'm not persuaded by the notion that the regulated community would be unsettled by substituting a different time frame for 120 days. Some rules, if rewritten, would introduce some instability into the regulatory environment, but a simple change, if you will, in the time frame within which people have to operate doesn't strike me as an enormous challenge that would create problems for compliance in this coming election cycle.
Thank you. I think my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Commissioner Mason.
Thank you. I wanted to I appreciate Mr. Bauer's comment about having to justify restrictions on speech, but I wanted to go back to this lobbying issue. It seems to me, under some of the more expansive proposals, that what's being presented to the Chamber of Commerce or someone in that situation is a choice between talking to members on the one hand and running ads targeting the members or regarding them on the other. And I just wanted to get a little understanding. I mean, it seems to me that in the progression, and you know, if we could just for the moment concede there's no ill intent here and there's a legitimate lobbying purpose and that's what people are interested in, that what normally would happen is a lobbying organization would talk to the member of Congress or staff and determine his position, and if he's solidly with them, they may decide they don't need to run ads. And if he's irretrievably against them, they might decide. And if he's in the middle, That might well be the case where they're going to run the ads, and then they might well run the ads, and then presumably after they've run the ads and generated some phone calls, they want to come back. Is that how it works? And if it is, what, you know, what kind of problems are presented by essentially saying, well, yeah, you can run the ads, but you can't talk to the target of the lobbying effort? Mr. Barron.
Well, there is a tension here, and it's even reflected in the legislative history. I think we cited on page 19 of our comments some legislative statements by Senator McCain about, well, you know, we don't mean to interfere with the right of lobbying and so forth, but you can't lobby without intersecting with people who, wearing a different hat, are also candidates for re-election to the House or to the Senate, and of course their staffs are agents of those officials under your regulations. So you're dealing with candidates and their agents, and under the current coordination rules, you know, the advice that we private practitioners offer our clients is don't ever talk about their campaigns, whatever you do, just talk about the issues. And yet one of the proposals from the reform community is to modify your regulations so that at some period of time in the 30-60-day period, not only would advertisements or public communications that reference a candidate or a political party be subject to coordination rules, but ads that they call thematic ads that don't reference a party or name a candidate. So I don't know what that means. You know, if some organization was lobbying for more wheat in this country and then subsequently in this time period, after consulting with congressmen and senators and their staff, start public communications that say, you know, buy more wheat. Whether all of a sudden they've now coordinated their ad because there's a thematic dimension to it because the candidate is going to be in support of more wheat in his or her advertising. those types of vague concepts, if you were to extend them, would not only present a lot of constitutional issues, but you would, you know, have these types of practical implications, particularly for people who are exercising their rights to lobby Congress.
All right, but just to go back, on normal lobbying practices, the normal practice is to talk to members of Congress, and that's what's fundamental about it.
Members of Congress and staff, of which there is approximately 30,000 the last time I checked, yes, it's quite normal.
All right, and so effectively, if we cast a very broad rule that would implicate some of this content, that we would be presenting you with a choice that you would have to effectively cease the person-to-person lobbying activities if you wanted to do grassroots.
We would have a practical choice of forfeiting one constitutional right in favor of another one, potentially, and then separately affected organizations would have to consider doing what the reform community did to you, which is to sue you about their constitutional rights. Yeah. So, yes, it would have multiple implications.
I think we face that risk anyway. Mr. Simon, I don't really have a question about your proposal, but I do have a comment, and you may want to respond. My concern about trying to get these regulations out is to get regulations that non-attorney practitioners can understand. It may require attorneys to explain them and, you know, so on like that, but the members of Congress, are many of them are attorneys, but they're not practicing. They're not looking at it with a lawyer's hat on. The staff members, the people in these organizations, and so on. And so if we have simple, clear proposals, of course, we're going to run the risk between over-inclusiveness and under-inclusiveness and so on like that. But I frankly find the proposal laid out in your testimony is sort of baffling because the only thing I can compare it to is something like a game of three-dimensional chess. Okay, we've got standards based on the identity of the speaker, political committee, 527, or somebody else. I've identified at least those three, and there might be others lurking there. We've got content standards, which are a theme, a clearly identified candidate, promote, support, attack, or oppose, express advocacy, or the character, qualifications, and fitness for office. And frankly, the PASO standard and the character standard are not well litigated or well explained. So there would be, I think, frankly, big questions about, at least as to the borderline, you know, in those areas. And then we have, I don't know, three or four or five different time frames, you know, and so we have this sort of three-dimensional axis out there. And I guess the question is, do you really believe that that is a regulation that promotes compliance and that we could enforce with any reasonable degree of resources?
Yeah, I would like to comment on that, and then I actually would really like a chance to respond to Mr. Barron's analysis of the appendix material we submitted, because I have a very different view of what that evidence stands for. I don't think the rule we proposed, and we went to kind of extra length, I think, in trying to draft it out, which may not have been advisable, rather than explain it more conceptually. I don't think it's as complicated as you portray it, and I don't think it significantly goes beyond the complexity of the Commission's existing rule. It does require a kind of initial sorting as to whether you are a political committee or a 527 or somebody else. That's not a hard standard. And then there are simply three time frames, a 30-60-day standard, 120-day standard, and beyond 120 days. And beyond that, the rule is largely based on the Commission's existing approach of within that 120-day period, if you refer to a candidate and target an ad to that candidate's district, then you meet the content test. So really, at heart, it is built on the existing rule. As to Mr. Barron's analysis of the ads we submitted in the appendix, I disagree with him about the relevance of the candidate ads. We deliberately searched for and submitted ads run not only by outside groups, but ads run by candidates as well outside the 120-day period. And I think, in a way, those ads are more probative than the ads by the outside groups themselves. In part, this was in response to a question asked by the court. I mean, one of the questions the D.C. Circuit asked was, do candidates, in fact, limit campaign-related advocacy to the 4 months surrounding our elections, or does substantial election-related communications occur outside the window? So one of the things the court was interested in are whether candidates themselves run ads outside the 120-day window. Now, why is that particularly important here? In terms, and this goes to the difference between the rules for coordinated communications and the rules for independent communications. The importance of the rules for coordinated communications is that if something is not coordinated as a matter of law because it is outside the time frame and therefore is outside the Commission's coordination rules, that means that an ad could be written by the candidate, as I said in my opening comments, and just given to an outside spender, and the candidate could tell the outside spender to go use the corporate or union treasury money to run those ads. So if you look at the ads that we've produced that are candidate ads, every one of those ads under your rules could have been funded entirely by a corporate or union spender, because absent the application of the coordination rules, there's no limit on how the candidate and the spender can interact over the content, timing, placement of the ad. And so that's why those ads are particularly relevant, because they show candidates do run ads outside the window. These ads have value to candidates, and under the existing rule, each of those ads could be funded with soft money provided by a corporation or union. And I think that is a particularly important point.
Thank you. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to follow up on Commissioner Mason's point, because I also find the proposal to be very complex. And I'd like to ask Mr. Barron and Mr. Bauer, who I know spend most of their working day advising people on how to comply with our rules, whether you think this is a work, the proposal that's put forth by Mr. Simon and his colleagues is a workable proposal that you could explain to your clients and that you could advise them how to comply with the law without running, interfering with activities that you think are otherwise protected.
No.
No.
Do you want to elaborate on that at all?
I think Don made a valiant effort to say, well, it builds on the commission's rules, and it's not complicated, but it is complicated because there is a desire to reach out in a variety of directions and try to nab, if you will, various speech wrongdoers who may be trying to circumvent the campaign finance laws. And so, as a result, it has more moving parts, more complexity than a rule that is streamlined for clearer understanding and much more easily facilitated compliance. And that goes just fundamentally to a difference in approach. Don knows I know that I believe this. We've talked about this a fair amount. I mean, I think you at some point, and Jan made a comment about this earlier, you have to start with a rule that you think is designed precisely, clearly, and likely to attract compliance.
Narrowly tailored, perhaps?
Pardon me?
Narrowly tailored, perhaps?
Not assume, just because you think it's in the nature of things that it will promote widespread evasion, and then allow a record to build to the contrary if such a record can be built. This agency is not without the authority to respond to evidence that its regulations are not working. And so we don't have to anticipate in each instance 6, 7, or 8 scenarios, even within, by the way, your constitutional authority to regulate. Let's assume that there are scenarios that you can respond to with regulation in a constitutional fashion, but you don't have to immediately assume that you can anticipate each and every kind of evasion and then build a rule that is aggressive, multi-pronged enough to catch up with all this anticipated wrongdoing. I think you start with something that's reasonable and well-founded, and for the most part, as Jan pointed out, the Court of Appeals was not troubled with the way the rule, the current coordination communications rule, is constructed. It's simply seeking additional explanation. And then there's time available for us to determine whether or not it's working the way it is. But to start now with a rule like Don's and explain it to our clients might be very enriching for Jan and myself in a pecuniary sense, but it would not be otherwise, I think, helpful to our clients.
Well, I have to say, I have to, actually, next week we're having an agency conference, and I get to explain coordination, and I am completely intimidated at the prospect of having to explain this rule. I think it's very complicated. But I have a different question that I would like to pose to Mr. Simon. Aside from the complexity of the rule, and I think there are some aspects of it, which if I have more time, I'll come back and ask you about, because I'm not sure I get the point, but I'm frustrated by the situation that we find ourselves in, as I'm sure you are, all of you. Mr. Simon, you have successfully sued this agency and asked courts, and they have been willing to do this, to throw out regulations based on the fact that we have improperly noticed the rule in our notice of proposed rulemaking and people didn't have adequate opportunity to comment on it. Now, we asked our lawyers to come up with, you know, virtually everything that they could think of that, you know, might go into a good coordination rule, and I think they were pretty ingenious, but of course they didn't think of everything, and you guys thought of some new ideas, and that's great. But at this point, if we were to enact the rule that you suggest, I think that somebody, perhaps one of your co-panelists, would sue us on the exact same grounds that you've sued us on successfully in the past, and that they would win because we didn't have your proposal in our NPRM. At the same time, if we were to say, well, we think this is really interesting and we would like to be put ourselves in a legal position where we could enact this and not have that challenge, so we need to re-notice the rule, I am fairly well convinced that if we tried to re-notice our coordination rule, you would be back in court in about 30 seconds flat complaining to the judge that we were delaying the implementation of a new coordination rule. And I'd be happy to have you tell me that I'm wrong about that, but that's my sense. So we can't really do what you want us to do, I think, and survive legal challenge. You'll complain if we try and put ourselves in a position. You'll, I think, sue us if we try and put ourselves in a position to do that. And at the same time, my experience with your client is that if we don't enact every single suggestion, you know, some of them isn't enough, all of them have to be included in our rules, then you will not only sue us, but you will blast fax every media outlet in the country talking about what personally horrible people we are, evil, immoral, corrupt, reprehensible. I've lost track of all the adjectives over the years. And I just find myself in a box that I can't figure out a way out of. So my serious question to you, and I mean this really sincerely, what do you think that we can legally do without putting ourselves in a situation where, you know, they're going to sue us and it'll be thrown out in court, without you running into court and complaining about what we're going to do, that you would be satisfied with?
Well, if you feel that you're in a box, I think it is at least in part a box of your own construction.
Remember, I wasn't here for the last round.
No, it's not an issue of the last round. It's an issue of this round. It's been something like 15 months since the district court in the Shays case denied the commission's motion for a stay pending appeal and directed the commission to have new effective rules in place for the 2006 cycle. Now, this rule is probably the most complicated and contentious and controversial of all the rules that you had, and for reasons of your own choosing, you decided to leave this to last and to the what I think is the 11th hour of this litigation process. And I think, you know, that was an unfortunate choice, and I don't know why the commission chose to organize its work that way, but I think that's part of the reason behind the dilemma that you face. Let me also observe that the proposal we suggest is, you know, very largely, if not entirely, built on concepts and proposals contained in or discussed in the NPRM. I think virtually every piece of what we put together is taken from one portion or one proposal in the NPRM or another. Now, you know, whether that in itself satisfies an APA notice standard, frankly, I haven't thought through that question. I guess, you know, implicit in the fact that we made this proposal is the idea that we think you have the authority to adopt it, but I haven't specifically thought that through in reference to the question you're asking.
Well, I'll just point out, and I know my time is up, Mr. Chairman, that the Court of Appeals decision, which substantially changed the parameters of what we're doing here today, was not issued until July 15th, 2005. So the fact that the district court did something 15 months ago is really not the operative date. But, you know, what I hear you saying, Mr. Simon, is that I'm not getting an answer to my question as to what we could legally do to that would make you happy. I just
if I wasn't clear, let me be clear. What would make us happy would be to promulgate a rule along the lines of what we proposed.
Thank you. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Bauer, one of the things you commented on was changing the rule so that endorsement of other candidates by a candidate is not included in this. One thing you didn't talk about, and I wonder whether you've got a comment on this, is does the current rule also bring in a danger of keeping candidates out of commenting on, endorsing, or being involved in popular or very unpopular ballot initiatives in a state? Because if two candidates, for example, are both endorsing a particular ballot initiative, which, you know, is so popular an issue that could affect their election, is that going to be swept up into the rule?
Yes. I mean, I think the principles that create the problem for candidate endorsements create a problem for any time a federal candidate appears in an advertisement for endorsement purposes of any political communication, whether it's a political communication on behalf of a state and local candidate or one on behalf of a ballot initiative. And our suggestion was, and I just want to emphasize it here, that there are certain cases the Commission has recognized are special cases and present a strong independent ground for regulatory relief, and it seems to me that the difficulties presented by these regulations, by the development of the law, for both candidate endorsements and, for that matter, candidate assistance to parties and other candidates in signing fundraising appeals, are examples of those special cases, and they can be addressed as special cases, which the Commission has done in other contexts, for example, in providing for corporations under certain defined conditions to endorse candidates.
Can I ask another question about expenditures for coordinated communications? I mean, my understanding of the way the campaign process works, and I'm wondering whether it's somehow different now, is that the vast majority of the money that's spent on political communications is done after Labor Day in the 2 months right before the election. That's where the vast amount of money is spent, which would be within a 60-day rule, for example. And part of that also is, you know, I've been in this town now 4 years, and I know that August is the time the city basically shuts down because Congress takes a recess, and what happens is they all go home to their districts. And for people who want to do issue advertising on specific matters before Congress that they want to lobby, the ideal time to do advertising on those issues, I think, is in August when they're in their home districts doing all their town meetings. And again, do we have a danger of sweeping into this those kind of lobbying advertisements?
Just, I think Mr. Graham would like to comment on that too, maybe Mr. Simon also, but I don't think there's any doubt about that, that is an opportune time. It's an example, again, where it may well be that the advertiser thinks that the election pressures of the time will focus the office holder, even an office holder unopposed, an office holder with no chance of losing, but an office holder nonetheless sort of caught up with the politics of the season, will focus them while they're home with their constituents on the message that is meant to be communicated. So you're quite right. That is a very rich period for communicating in grassroots terms with elected officials.
I think there are multiple sources of data, including your own records here at the Commission, of when political money is spent and how it's spent. I mean, there are voluminous databases on that. I would just point out that your existing 120-day rule certainly would cover even the August period in terms of making coordination applicable. Seems to have worked in the one election that we've experienced under the McCain-Feingold law. I think that you do have a pretty clear option here of basically keeping the rule in place and seeing if it will work again as it has in the last election, which was an even bigger election than the one we're coming up to because it had a presidential campaign involved as well, and more money was raised and spent as a result of that.
Let me just say in response to that, there's no prohibition on a grassroots lobbying ad in August if it's run independently of a candidate. That would be a matter that's dealt with by Title II, and at any time prior to the 60-day period before the general election, the applicable test for an independent expenditure is express advocacy. In terms of a coordinated expenditure, as Mr. Barron pointed out, the August period is covered by the Commission's existing rule. So if it's a problem, it's a problem that existed in the last cycle and that the Commission has already thought through in the 2002 rulemaking and decided that the balance is in favor of covering ads within the 120-day period.
Simon, reading your the testimony you've submitted, I think you're unhappy with the express advocacy rule. What would you replace it with?
Well, as we suggest, we would replace it with a broader time frame test, and then outside the time frame, we recommend a suggestion made in the NPRM about ads that refer to the qualifications, character, or fitness of a candidate. That's a test that the Commission has talked about in previous rulemakings, that the Commission has said has a more objective character to it. And I think that's a test that intuitively suggests that an ad is campaign-related when you're talking about the character, qualifications, or fitness for office of a candidate.
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical then. It's an election year, presidential election year. The country is involved in an unpopular war, and a group they fit all the other rules, but they, we're talking here about the advocacy issue, but they run an ad showing the president, say, at the White House on the South Lawn. The military is there, and they have their saluting guns set up. And they manipulate what was previous footage so that when the saluting guns go off as the president is walking by, one of the wads comes out and hits the president. And there's a thing in the ad that says, well, it's too bad this didn't really happen, because then we wouldn't have to worry about this president in November. Would that fit within your what you believe should be banned?
Well, first of all, we're not suggesting a ban. This is a rule about coordinated communication.
I understand, but I mean, do you think it should fit within that rule?
Well, secondly, in your hypothetical, you said in this election year, and in the rule we proposed, the time frame would cover from 120 days prior to the primary through the general election. So I think it would be covered as part of the rule if it refers to a clearly identified candidate.
Well, that's very interesting, Mr. Simon, because 2008 will be the 200th anniversary of the passage of the Alien and Sedition Act. And one of the people who was convicted and fined $100 under that act was a man from New Jersey named Luther Baldwin, who said in a presidential election year that he wished a wad from the presidential saluting cannon might hit Adams in the ass. And you're basically telling me, I think, that we should reconstitute those acts in a way to restrict the political speech of individuals.
Well, again, the premise of the hypothetical is that we're talking about a coordinated communication, so presumably the conduct standard is that this communication was coordinated with the political opponent of the president, the candidate running against the president, or the political party of that candidate. And if there is that kind of coordination in an election year with the opponent of the candidate referenced in the election, I think the Supreme Court doctrine is pretty clear. That can be considered as a coordinated expenditure, and the doctrine is also clear that it can be considered, therefore, as an in-kind contribution, and the doctrine is also clear that corporations and labor unions are prohibited from making contributions to political candidates or parties.
I think the lesson here is not to coordinate with Thomas Jefferson.
Mr. Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Simon, I'd like to start with a question about your proposal. If I understand correctly, for 527 groups, you are proposing a content standard within 120 days of refer to the candidate, a clearly identified candidate or party, and outside of 120 days, the PASO standard. And to take sort of a variation on Commissioner Weintraub's question, if we find ourselves back in court, we adopt that proposal. And we find ourselves back in court in a suit filed by a 527 organization, and the court says, okay, FEC, what's your empirical basis for, not your logical basis, I understand the argument in your papers, but what is your empirical basis for choosing 120 days and concluding that within 120 days you're going to cover clearly identified, and outside of 120 days you're going to use the PASO standard? What's our response?
Well, from my point of view, the problem with the time frame test and what puts so much pressure on the time frame test in the Shays litigation was that it was essentially the only test in the content standard, and that outside the 120 days, no test applied. I mean, technically express advocacy applied, but you know, as the court said, that's a functionally meaningless test. So essentially there was no content standard outside the 120 days. I think if you have some reasonable content standard outside the 120 days, it takes the pressure off how precise you have to be in justifying the 120 days itself. In other words, I think you have to look at it as a package, not as separate elements. And having a PASO test, which I think can be applied to 527 groups outside the 120 days, I think, as I said, puts less pressure on the commission having to justify the 120 days itself. Now, let me just also add, you know, the 527 aspect here, I think, is part of what makes the rule complicated, and in part that's because of where the commission left the 527 issue and the relationship between the 527s and political committee status. If you went back and clarified the standards under which 527s become political committees, it would simplify this a lot, and you could probably treat 527s, a lot of 527s, under the political committee part of the rule.
Mr. Barron, if I could ask you sort of a variation of the same question. You suggest the commission ought to keep the 120-day content standard. You make the point that there isn't any evidence of widespread circumvention of the 120-day rule. But apart from that point, if we're back in court and we retain the 120-day standard, what empirical evidence, if any, are you aware of from which the commission could rely, continue to rely, on a 120-day window as opposed to some other time window?
I think the empirical evidence has been submitted by Mr. Simon here.
Doesn't that just show that there are campaign ads running outside of 120 days?
Sure, but this regulation doesn't apply to campaign ads. I mean, there are lots of campaign ads, not as many as there are before an election, by the way. I mean, you could take that empirical data and compare it to the number of campaign ads that occur 30 days and 60 days before an election. You'll see a big spike up like this. You have examples here of candidates, mostly challengers or somebody who's in real trouble, who wants to get their name ID up and things of that sort in various places around the country. But this rule doesn't apply to that. This rule applies to people like my clients, you know, who may have something to say about something in a non-election year. And the question is, should do coordination rules need to apply to advertising outside of that time period? And you have two pieces of evidence here. One is that there is absolutely no demonstration that this is any sort of a problem, let alone a widespread problem, because there's so little advertising that goes on, according to the evidence submitted here, beyond 120 days, none of which is alleged to be coordinated with any candidate. So you have no evidence of a problem. And number two, you already have longstanding regulations that acknowledge that when it comes to a campaign poll, that it's essentially worthless over some period of time, because it has no value. It may have some correlation to a campaign. Obviously, a poll has a correlation to campaigns. You know, it wages public opinion at a moment in time. But that public opinion changes quite rapidly and depreciates to the point where it's, under your own regulations, cannot even be an expenditure or contribution after 120 days at all. And I think that tacitly acknowledges what we all know, which is that there's a lot of stuff that goes on well before elections that is essentially worthless. So why extend your regulations to worthless activity?
Thank you. I see my time is up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Norton. Mr. Costa.
Yes. Good morning, and thank you for your testimony. I have only one question, and it's directed to Jan Barron and Bob Bauer. And it's sort of to wrap up, I think, this round. Are you aware of any other compliance issues which have been raised by your clients in adhering to the existing 120-day Bright Line rule? And if so, what are they? I mean, you have a 120-day rule out there now. It's been in effect for a cycle. Are there any other things? You have a forum here to let us know if there are such things.
Are you referring to compliance issues raised by the coordination rules, other than
by
the
yes, by that bright line rule? Yes.
That'll cut down on the time we spend on that.
No. I mean, I think that I agree with Mr. Barron that the rule appears to be one that the regulated community has been able to grasp, and that other than this unsettled issue, it's functioned well, and there's no reason to believe that it can't function well for another cycle.
Well, I will have to say that there's not a very clear understanding of what a material contact is or material information under your conduct rule or, forgive me if I get the phrase wrong, frequent contact and things of that sort. But, you know, it hasn't come up in concrete experience. I mean, people read those regulations, they say, well, what does that mean? We're not really sure. And otherwise, I think you're at a stage where your existing rules have been sort of synthesized by people like Mr. Bauer and myself to clients. I mean, our summary of your rule is about 10 pages long, you know, but we lay it all out and we send it out. I even have about 8 pages in my book about your coordination rule, and people go through that, and they have had an election cycle where they have become familiar with it. They seem to follow it by and large. There may be exceptions that we're not aware of, but I think it's a pretty solid start, and the Court of Appeals has basically said your rules are okay except for this 120-day issue, which you have an opportunity to clarify now. And if you're able to do that, then I think you've got a set of rules that seem to be working and should continue to work until proven that they're ineffective.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Costa. Well, we have time for another round of questions. I assume that there's interest in that, so I'll begin the second round. Mr. Simon, I'd like to begin with you. The general counsel asked you some questions about how your proposal would work with regard to 527 groups. I'd be interested in learning more about how your proposal would work with regard to political committees. And as I understand it, the proposal would essentially say if the conduct prong is satisfied, that the content standard would look to whether or not the communication was made for the purpose of influencing a federal election. And as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that standard could be triggered regardless of whether or not a candidate or political party is depicted in the communication. That standard could be triggered regardless of when the advertisement airs, even if it's years before an election. Two questions. One, is my understanding correct that that's sort of the guts of the proposed content standard for political committees? And second of all, if it is, how would that work? What does that mean for the purpose of influencing?
You know, in terms of political committees, I think the expenditure standard, the for purpose of influencing definition, is self-executing. I don't think the commission has or needs to have any additional definition. I mean, political committees recognize and report their expenditures. They allocate their expenditures. They have to be able to identify their expenditures, and they do so without any narrowing or limiting test.
But in fairness, if you spend money and you engage in a disbursement, that's a concrete action that you're aware of. But here we're talking about certain communications that are going to be treated as in-kind contributions. What if we applied it for purpose of influencing test? What criteria would we bring to bear in making that judgment?
I think you look at the communication and decide whether it's for the purpose of influencing the election of the candidate that it was coordinated with.
Is that tantamount to sort of we know it when we see it? Is that where we'd be, to, you know, quote Potter Stewart? I mean, is that a fair assessment?
No, I think it is a fair assessment. I don't know that.
Are you comfortable with that constitutionally?
Yeah. Well, yes, I am, because I think the Supreme Court in Buckley was very clear that the need for a narrowing interpretation of the for the purpose of influencing language did not apply to candidates or political committees, that the court found the for the purpose of influencing standard and the term contribution and expenditure sufficiently clear when applied to candidates and political committees. It was only in another context of applying to outside groups, to corporations, to labor unions, to individuals, where the court said there was any need for a limiting standard. Let me also note,
but in fairness, I don't recall the Buckley court fleshing out this precise issue of what the standard ought to be with respect to coordinated communications.
Well,
just acknowledged the general principle. Is that right? Did not purport to establish a standard for that.
If a standard wasn't needed in the context of independent expenditures, then certainly I don't think it would be needed in the context of coordinated expenditures. But let me also note that this issue came up in McConnell in the sense that Mr. Barron's client challenged Section 214 of BCRA, which is the coordinated expenditure portion of BCRA, and the claims they raised included a claim that The language of the coordinated expenditure provision is not sufficiently clear, is vague, did chill speech, did lead to the possibility of discriminatory enforcement. And the Supreme Court rejected all those claims and upheld the language on its face. So, you know, particularly in the context of political committees, I just don't think there's a need for any kind of narrow interpretation.
So at bottom, with respect to political committees, you'd be comfortable with the agency evaluating it based on we know it and we see it?
I think this agency knows what expenditures by political committees are.
Mr. Barron, your thoughts?
Well, I think Don is correct in his reference to the Buckley case, but of course that analysis only dealt in terms of one aspect of the expenditure issue. The issue you're raising really was addressed in Colorado One, where the commission for many years had a regulation that said that all expenditures by political committees should be treated as coordinated.
Irrebuttable presumption.
An irrebuttable presumption, which was rejected. And as part of the case, of course, there were some arguments made that, well, those expenditures by the Colorado party should still be treated as coordinated because the party had some contacts with the candidates who were running in the primary, and the court made some conclusion in reference to saying, well, you know, this type of incidental association and intersection between party committees and candidates is not coordination. And besides, the money was spent months before the primary and things of that sort. There was even a reference to how it couldn't be coordinated because it really wasn't proximate to the election itself. I think it was less than 120 days to the primary. What constitutes a coordinated party expenditure still has not been fleshed out, except for your existing regulations. So to put the parties in some other category, make them subject to other coordination regulations, I think is not justified and probably would violate the principles enunciated both in Colorado One and in McConnell that says that you can't treat political parties any differently for purposes of independent expenditures than you would treat someone else. So you have to be consistent in how you define coordination, whether it's the party committee or a third party.
If I could ask this one, please. Mr. Bauer, do you believe that we could lawfully, constitutionally have a coordination standard that turned on the purpose of influencing?
No.
Why?
Because, I mean, first of all, I'm not astonished, because I think Mr. Simon is a new parent, is working through his sleep deprivation admirably.
But I'm wishing him the best in that regard.
I think he's doing extraordinarily well. But having said all of that,
We've all been there.
We, in his exchange with Commissioner Weintraub, there was obviously reference to the repeated lawsuits filed by his client against the Federal Election Commission alleging its incompetence in a variety of respects, in some cases not just incompetence but sort of studied wrongdoing. And here's Mr. Simon telling you that he'd be happy to provide you with a test in which you could sort of decide on the basis of feel and intuition whether a particular advertisement was for the purpose of influencing an election. So the compliance policy that he's articulating here, at least the regulatory theory he's articulating, is hard for me to follow.
Mr. Simon, I
admire the way he's put it.
Mr. Simon, your thoughts,
well,
and I'm sorry, that'll be my last question.
Yeah, no, I just wanted, in response to what Jan said, I mean, the Colorado One case was about the conduct prong, not the content prong. The result of Colorado One was that the spending at issue was an independent expenditure, not a coordinated expenditure. There wasn't an issue in the case about whether it was an expenditure of one sort or another.
Thank you. My time has expired. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. My earlier questions have been directed at Mr. Barron and Bauer, and so I'll use this round to ask you, Mr. Simon. To your mind, as you look at the record that you've submitted, how big is this problem? Do you have a sense of the how we quantify this, the percentage of money that was spent to influence an election outside of these 120-day time periods, as opposed to inside?
I don't know, and I don't contest the proposition that more money is spent within 120 days than is spent outside 120 days, or that more money is spent, you know, within 60 days than between 60 and 120 days. I mean, I think that's not the issue. The issue in this context, not in the context of Title II where we're talking about independent expenditures, which is under a different constitutional standard, the issue in this context where we're talking about coordinated expenditures, which are the equivalent of in-kind contributions to candidates, the issue is whether I think political advertising is running, whether candidates run that advertising, and whether saying that advertising run by candidates and or outside groups can be coordinated without limit up to and including the point of having an outside spender simply pay for an ad drafted by a candidate constituting a contribution, in effect, an in-kind contribution to the candidate. That is the problem I think you have to focus on. In this context, what a time frame does as a sole test is essentially put a time frame on the ban on corporate or union contributions to candidates. And although outside the 120-day window, a corporate officer could not walk up to a candidate and say, here's a check for $100,000 as a contribution, that corporate officer could walk up to a candidate and say, give me your ad text, and I'll spend $100,000 running that ad where and when you want me to. It's functionally a contribution, and the harm of the time frame test is to the extent candidates advertise outside that 120-day window, which they clearly do, you are essentially allowing unlimited soft money contributions to be raised and spent by those candidates, and I think that's impermissible.
So your sense is that the problem isn't really the number of days we've chosen, but that the views to date, we couldn't pick a set number of days that would adequately capture this?
It's not 90 days versus 60 days versus 120 days. It's that there's no meaningful test whatsoever outside the time frame that you chose.
So if we were to look at the record and find that there was a period of time in which there was no meaningful amount of spending, even by candidates, to influence elections, and we chose that date, we would still be at a risk because presumably in the future, the court asked us to try and anticipate circumvention and people could adjust their behavior accordingly?
I think the further out you go, the severity of the problem diminishes. We found what I think is a significant amount of advertising by candidates in the period outside 120 days. If it was 180 days, I don't know what would be there. I think there is generally a trend towards earlier advertising. I think certainly under the way the rule currently works, in the period between the end of the primaries in, say, March or April and the beginning of the pre-general election period in July, there's certainly a lot of advertising that takes place in that period by candidates, and at a minimum, I think you need to fill in that gap period. But I mean, we're not suggesting you should move the 120 days to 150 days or 180 days. We're saying if you want to keep that 120 days, you need to supplement it with something that will identify coordinated ads outside that 120 day period.
And so, going back to an attempt to sort of look at a quantification or a measure of the problem, do you have a sense of given the record that you've submitted, whether the problem really lies in the period prior to the 120-day period prior to the primary, or is the gap period between the primary and the general, or is it all of a like kind and equally regulatory?
It's both. It's both in the sense that we identified, I think, a significant number of ads in both periods. To my mind, the problem is more acute in the gap period because then you're talking about ads in the election year, 5 months before the general election. Which I think was very much the heart of the electoral season. Certainly, if you look at 2004, there was a significant amount of candidate advertising going on in the period between the end of the primaries and July. And indeed, one of the 527 groups, the Media Fund, was formed for the purpose of running ads in that period after the primaries up until the convention. They were worried about Senator Kerry, being up against running out of money, or I think at the time they were formed, there was still a question of whether he was going to opt into public financing and be caught by the spending ceiling. But certainly that was viewed as an important period for political advertising.
Mr. Chairman, I see my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Commissioner Mason?
Thank you. I want to try to get one thing to, understood, and it goes back a little bit to some of these questions about Colorado and the party activity, but I want to encourage the panelists to think also about BCRA and the McConnell decision in that regard. Do you think we could fairly say that if candidates don't have perhaps a right to coordinate with political parties about party committee activity, that under the statute and under the construction of the statute promulgated in McConnell, that there's an expectation that candidates will be coordinating with their own party committees about political activity going on in the pre-election period? Does anyone disagree with that?
Well, I think that operationally, in part because of the law, that that will occur in many instances, because parties are given an increased limit where they are permitted to make coordinated.
Well, I'm not thinking about the coordinated. No, I'm thinking about things like generic party activity. And I don't mean anything where somebody's trying to be tricky or whatever, but the party has a get-out-the-vote drive, or the party has generic ads, and it seems to me that there are implications, at least in some of these decisions and in the way the statute's constructed, that there's an expectation that candidates would be coordinating with parties about that activity, and that's okay. All right, so that brings me to then a particular question about Mr. Simon's proposal, because he was responding to the chairman talking about purpose of influencing, and yet the proposal for political committees is directed to voters. So I don't know any other way to read that than to say, well, if the state party committee is planning a generic ad campaign, they're not going to mention any candidates. They want to do generic advertising on behalf of the party, and they want to talk to their candidates, federal and state, about, you know, what are the best themes? You know, should we talk about corruption? Should we talk about the war in Iraq? You know, what works better? And so the candidates have views on that, and they express those to the parties, and then the party runs an ad. Well, that ad is then directed to voters in the jurisdiction of the candidate with whom the communication is coordinated. So, Mr. Simon, haven't you caught up something that I think, you know, heretofore has been suspected to be an expected activity and not some sort of circumvention?
I mean, you know, that question, I take it, relates to whether that spending is part of the party's 441 AD spending, which is an issue that, you know, the commission used to deal with under an electioneering message test. If the ad mentions the candidate.
But your proposal says directed to voters. It doesn't say electioneering communication. Well, it doesn't say purpose of influencing. It says directed to voters.
It says expenditure, I believe.
Anything done by a political committee is an expenditure. Now, if you're going to tell me that the generic party advertising that says vote Republican to protect us from Osama bin Laden, or vote Democratic to clean up corruption, is not an expenditure, well, that's new ground.
No, but it may not have to be attributed to the particular candidate's 441 AD limit if it's not an expenditure for the purpose of influencing that candidate's election.
But this says expenditure directed to voters.
Well,
it doesn't say. You know, and that's because that gets to the nub of the issue about whether clearly identified candidate is a reasonable distinction. And you're rejecting clearly identified candidate and proposing directed to voters.
I mean, maybe this is a technical draftsmanship issue. The way I would read that is the term expenditure in that context would mean expenditure for the purpose of influencing that candidate's election and directed to the voters of that candidate's electorate.
And we determine that it's for the purpose of influencing that candidate's election by whether the candidate's name is in the ad?
I think that's one of the indicators.
One of. What else?
You know, the targeting and timing.
But we've already said that it's targeted to just that state. Maybe there are only three or four members of the House and one member of the Senate, and it's right before the election.
And if it mentions that candidate's name.
And it doesn't mention that candidate's name.
If it doesn't mention that candidate's name, it probably would not be.
Probably.
Yeah.
Well, and that's our problem.
Okay. I mean, you know, you have to develop standards on this.
So clearly identified candidate would really be better than directed to voters.
I don't know. I don't have an opinion on that.
trouble is we have to know.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bauer and Mr. Barron, you indicated earlier that while you don't want us to change a lot for stability's sake, you think that if we change the time window, that wouldn't be a problem. Would you still hold to that view if we change the time window to, say, 180 days?
No, because first of all, I'm trying.
Not.
Let me start by saying I'm trying to walk Mr. Barron from 120 to 60, and I'm having trouble over the course of this hearing. He seems to be going even beyond his written testimony to stress the adequacy, maybe even the desirability of 120 days. So he and I will have coffee afterwards. But in any event, beyond that, I like to stay close to the chamber. But beyond that, there would be no basis for coming to 180 days. I mean, the entire exercise here is to find a rational, well-grounded basis for arriving at a time frame, so why would we be happy with
well,
that?
Well, suppose that we could, you know, we looked at all the data that's been submitted to us, and we had hired a statistician, and we came to the conclusion that if you look at all the advertising that's done, there's, you know, you really capture most of the things you're concerned about in 180 days is an insignificant amount that goes on before that. Suppose, just assume we can justify it. My question is, would you then say, contrary to what you said earlier, oh, but changing the time window is now a big problem because we're making it broader rather than narrow.
You're asking two questions. I don't think it would be difficult for me to deliver the discouraging news to my clients that you'd extended the time frame without justification, without an adequate supporting record, and for no obvious reason in violation of the U.S. Constitution. That's one message. The other message is, could they comply with it? Yes.
I'm not getting much out of this exchange, so let me move on.
Oh, you got two answers. Come on.
The court asked us, the Court of Appeals asked us to consider three questions, and I think that Mr. Simon and his friends have made an attempt at the first one. Do candidates, in fact, limit campaign-related advocacy to the 4 months surrounding elections, or does substantial election-related communication occur outside that window? The second question the court asked us to address, which none of you commented on that I saw, was whether we should have different standards for congressional, senatorial, and presidential races, and I'd just like to ask whether any of you have an opinion on that.
I guess my opinion is that you should not have different standards.
I don't think there ought to be different standards, but I would point out that your existing rules have different effects. I mean, you know, the Iowa caucus is in January. I think the first congressional primary is in Illinois in March. You know, so you have a rule that applies to all campaigns, but the effect may be different.
Ms. Bauer, any thoughts?
No, I don't believe standards should be different. And I apologize if I didn't answer your earlier question. I do not believe changing from 60 to 180 would be difficult to comply with. I mean, changing the date, it seems to me, either way, can't be a problem. It's just the question of whether or not you've done what the court have asked you to do, which is to anchor it in something defensible.
The court also asked us to address what I think is sort of, frankly, an impossible question. Perhaps most important, to the extent election-related advocacy now occurs primarily within 120 days, would candidates and collaborators, I love that term, collaborators, aiming to influence elections simply shift coordinated spending outside that period to avoid the challenge rules restrictions? In other words, if you make it illegal here, would they do what is legal when they can no longer do what is illegal? Is there any period of time that we could come up with that wouldn't have that effect?
I think you could respond to the court by saying, based on the application of our rule in the last election, the answer is no. It hasn't happened. Now, if the court wants to speculate on what behavior might be modified in the future, I mean, I don't see how you could engage in speculation. What we know as a matter of fact, that did not happen.
Mr. Simon?
Obviously that's a hard question to answer because it's it does call for speculation.
Why they pay us the big bucks.
I think to the extent that a time frame got pushed out more remote from the election and the commission could conclude that prior to the time frame, candidates were not running ads, I think that could be some evidence that there's less likelihood that spending would shift outside that time frame. I don't think that's true for the 120 day.
But what period? Do you have any theory on what that period?
I don't know.
No.
I don't have any other particular period in mind.
Right. Are you aware in that, you know, when you were looking through all those ads that you put together for us, are you aware of coordinated advertising that went on outside of the 120-day window?
No, and there's no way that we could be aware of it. I mean, you can't tell from the face of the ad whether it was coordinated or not.
Mr. Bauer has asked that we put in certain safe harbors for things like firewalls and fundraising by candidates for party committees. You don't like those ideas, Mr. Simon. At least that's what your testimony said, your written testimony said. Could you elaborate on what the problem is?
Well, you know, on the firewall issue, let me just note that in the 2002 rulemaking, the commission considered that and said the commission does not agree that the mere existence of an ethical screen should provide a de facto bar to the enforcement of limits on coordinated communications imposed by Congress. Without some mechanism to ensure enforcement, these private arrangements are unlikely to prevent circumvention of the rules. That was the commission's own conclusion in 2002 about the use of firewalls, and the commission found firewalls, just accepting the assertion that a firewall exists, as an inadequate means to prevent circumvention, and I agree with that. I don't think it's adequate just to accept the sort of facial representation. We have a firewall. It's accepting the facial representation we didn't coordinate, and I don't think that's sufficient. I think the use of firewalls is accepted practice in law firms. I think law firms are very different kinds of entities than political committees, and I think the analogy between the two kinds of entities doesn't translate well.
But if I could impose just one follow-up, but I'm trying to figure out what the – is it that you're afraid we're just going to accept the assertion of the firewall, or that you think no matter how they documented and provided evidence of the firewall, it still wouldn't be sufficient?
Well, I mean, mostly the former, that the proposal to me in the NPRM seemed to say if a group sets up a firewall or has a policy of having a firewall, that would be dispositive. And I don't think without the ability to look behind that to at least have some standards as to what a firewall consists of, what the mechanisms are for enforcing the integrity of the firewall, that the commission should just accept a bare representation of the adequacy of the firewall. I also note that in Mr. Bauer's comments, he suggests a kind of modified firewall where you have a firewall within an organization, but the head of the organization can be on both sides of the firewall. Well, you know, that seems to me to defeat the whole point.
Time's up. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Commissioner Von Spakovsky. Okay. Mr. General Counsel.
Want to follow up on the endorsement question, which Commissioner Von Spakovsky raised. And I guess, Mr. Bauer, my question is directed to you because you were a proponent of this. As you know, the court, there's much in the D.C. Circuit opinion about the importance of the commission considering the possibilities for circumvention. You make the point that endorsement ads really are for the benefit of the candidate being endorsed, and there is no evidence that they really used in a manner that would benefit the endorsing candidate. But let me posit this example that might occur, excuse me, if the commission established this safe harbor. The endorser is a publicly funded presidential election candidate who's running out of funds for the general election. Since public funding is a block grant, when the money is gone, it's gone. The endorsee who would be paying for the ad is a highly popular governor candidate who's expected to coast a re-election in a swing state where there are no contribution limits or prohibitions. There's an ad paid for by that governor where the endorser, the presidential candidate, is on screen for 90% of the time talking about his priorities and accomplishments, and the tagline is, "I endorse Governor X because I know he shares my goals and visions for America." Is that a realistic concern for the commission in if it were to establish a safe harbor for endorsements, that kind of ad?
Well, I think you'll agree with me that you've loaded the hypo, but I understand that the commission may want to say in the explanation and justification that their free, obviously, to determine in particular cases that rather than the normal course of these endorsement ads, the way in which we typically find them, the vast, vast majority of them, if not all of them so far, not really presenting any issues, that there may be circumstances in which somebody would press them and say, press the commission to determine whether, in fact, an endorsement was what it was presented to be. I'm not certain that's going to present an insuperable regulatory challenge. But let me step back and say this. It's certainly worth the effort. And why is it worth the effort? And why have we emphasized this one thing? Because in the whole complex of practices that we've been talking about here, endorsements, and of course I'm here as representing an organization of candidates, essentially, and that promotes candidacies. Of all the complex of practices we've discussed, the endorsement is time-honored, well-established, and politically vital and significant in a variety of ways. And I don't believe that prior to the Forgy-Kerr opinion that anybody really contemplated that we would find ourselves having to struggle to make room for endorsement under the BCRA-developed coordination standards. And I think the Commission should try to find a way to extricate it because, you know, Commissioner Spakovsky referred to the practices in the or the style of debate, rhetoric, and whatever in the Adams period. Throughout the entire political history of this country, nothing has been more critical in ways too complicated here to describe and not obviously within the immediate interest of the Commission. Nothing has been more significant, more consistent than the desire of candidates to associate through endorsements in a variety of ways, not to circumvent the statute since it long predates BCRA, but because it's politically so much a part of political dialogue and association in the United States. So it seems to be worth the effort for the Commission to find a way to pull that out of the melee here.
Mr. Simon, did you have anything to say on that point?
Well, you know, in some ways I agree with Bob on that. In the following sense. In this sense, in the typical endorsement ad that Bob's talking about, the candidate running the ad is not making an expenditure for the purpose of influencing the candidate who's doing the endorsement. So I think in the hypo you described, I think the candidate is making an expenditure for the presidential candidate, but in the typical endorsement ad where a candidate says I endorse, you know, so and so for the House, that's an expenditure for the purpose of influencing the candidate who's being endorsed, not for influencing the candidate who's doing the endorsement. In terms of a non-federal candidate, it seems to me the situation is controlled by 441IF, which is that a non-federal candidate cannot spend soft money for ads which PASO a federal candidate. So if the endorsement doesn't promote the candidate doing the endorsement, then it should be okay. But that would be the standard.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. General Counsel. Mr. Costa.
I have no further questions.
I have one question for the panel, and I think we have time if any commissioners have just final questions. I'd like to follow up on this endorsement proposal. And Mr. Bauer, would you be comfortable if we decided we were going to fashion a way to extricate ourselves from the endorsement situation, as you put it, that it would be permissible for these endorsements to take place, wouldn't trigger any in-kind contributions, even if the endorsing candidate consults with the makers of the communication, which makes sense. And part of the backdrop, I think, of the AO you alluded to was the common sense recognition that happens. When office holders are appearing in ads, their people are going to look at them and are likely, almost certainly, going to satisfy the conduct standard. Would you be satisfied if we fashioned an endorsement provision that allowed that activity to take place, have it be exempt, as long as there was no express advocacy for the endorsing candidate? So that we would look solely at that, and provided there was no express advocacy for the candidate doing the endorsing, it would be exempt.
I haven't considered how that would work into the totality of a rule, but nothing on the face of it troubles me on first thought.
And so, you know, General Counsel's hypothetical, the hypothetical script, we would evaluate whether or not there was express advocacy for the endorsing candidate in that scenario and in others.
Yes, I think I can hear Mr. Barron stirring next to me. What I'm trying to figure out is exactly how the express advocacy standard would be analyzed in those circumstances, but let me let you...
Well, I was going to follow up and say I believe your own regulations have defined express advocacy as simply the name of a candidate with an exclamation mark or something, right? So it's all kind of
slogans, certain slogans, and
yeah,
right, right.
Like Lamar, right, or whatever,
which was a forgettable slogan, but was one nevertheless.
Yeah, this kind of, I mean, 30 years ago, this agency grappled with this variation of the question when then Congressman Ed Koch produced a campaign button that said Koch Carter. And there was all of this gnashing of teeth and rending of garments as to whether he was making an in-kind contribution to the publicly financed campaign of then-Governor Jimmy Carter. And that eventually was resolved with an exception that would allow campaigns to, you know, basically promote each other. All this has been changed by McCain-Feingold. And I assume if Ed Koch were to run for New York mayor again, he might not be able to have that button with a more up-to-date variation, I'm sure. It seems to me that there ought to be some accommodation. I don't know if it's going to be possible in this rulemaking or what it's going to require, some amendment to the law, but this situation does have to accommodate the reality that campaigns for state and federal office tend to endorse each other.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for this panel? Commissioner Weintraub.
One follow-up to my last round of questions. On the issue of candidates soliciting for their party committees, one that's near and dear to your heart, I know, Mr. Bauer, you've made the point that it's really not to the candidate's benefit to be wandering around hat in hand for the collecting money for the party. It doesn't go to his campaign account, and it can't be earmarked. Mr. Simon, you still have you think those should be covered by coordination regulations?
Well, with apologies to Commissioner Mason, I guess I would still apply an expenditure test. If the candidate's solicitation in an ad is not for his benefit, which is what Mr. Bauer says, it's not promoting his election, it's not for the purpose of influencing his election, then it's not an expenditure, and under the test we propose, it wouldn't be covered under the content test.
So you're comfortable with making some kind of provision for
yes,
that?
Yes, but again, you know, the other side of that is Mr. Norton's hypothetical that, you know, just as in an endorsement ad, you could structure it in a way that it does benefit the candidate doing the endorsings, so too in a, you know, we could construct a hypothetical solicitation ad that would also benefit the candidate doing the solicitation. So my only point is there shouldn't be a kind of per se exception. There should be a standard, whether it's a PASO standard or for the purpose of influencing standard.
Well, it sounds like you're moving towards a PASO standard. Mr. Bauer, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I've always been concerned about extending the PASO standard beyond the specific circumstances in which Congress provided for it. But let me, if I could, just make a comment about, because we're happy, ending here on a happy note here, where Don is slowly migrating toward the other side of the table here on some points, at least with his usual qualifications. What I'm talking about, what I'd like to stress in the case of the firewall, in the case of the endorsements and whatever, is that nobody's suggesting that the Commission should fashion a dumb rule, or that the Commission surrenders upon fashioning a rule its regulatory authority or tosses its sense out the window. But what we're looking for, and this is something that it seems to me Don Simon's expenditure test repeatedly refuses to offer us, is something that we, as attorneys, all three of us, can tell our clients. Like, we'd like to tell them, this is what you can do, and this is what you cannot do. This will spare you illegal entanglement with Democracy 21. This will guarantee you a decade of it. And I think that is something that by going case by case in some of these circumstances and finding specific examples where even Don is not intuitively distressed at what we're proposing for endorsements or signed solicitations, the Commission would do us the service of helping our clients do what you want them to do, which is to comply with the law.
I'm gratified to hear that your clients are more concerned about entanglement with Democracy 21 than with the FEC. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. The Commission very much appreciates the three panelists being here this morning. We learned a great deal from you. We will be in recess for 10 minutes, and we'll start with the second panel at the bottom of the hour.